All right, joining me today is the great Will Grigg. He writes for freedominourtime.org. That's the Libertate, freedominourtime.org. And Will's always got the goods on the government armed thugs in costumes. Welcome, Will.
Ryan, it's great to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. I want to start micro and then move to the macro with something you wrote. Can you tell us first about what the state-approved criminals did to a Mr. David Eckert down in Deming? And I'd also like to probe into some of their other operations, smuggling heroin and firearms and things, but can we start with David? What happened to him, and I guess also to Timothy Young down in Deming?
It's appropriate to use the word probe because he was probed. He was sexually assaulted under the color of supposed state authority after being stopped by police in January of last year while he was pulling out of a Walmart parking lot there in Deming. He lives in a town nearby called Lordsburg, which is actually in a different county. It's Hidalgo County. Deming is in Luna County. And he was stopped after supposedly failing to come to a complete stop at a stop sign. The officer who stopped him didn't actually witness the infraction. He had received a phone call, actually, forgive me, not a phone call, a radio alert from another police officer who was watching the parking lot and didn't stop him. And I find that highly suspicious because if it's a moving violation that was witnessed by one police officer, presumably that police officer would make the stop. But my working thesis here is that Mr. Eckert was being kept under surveillance by the police. About 3 months, 4 months earlier, September of last year, he was stopped just a couple of blocks shy of his house there in Lordsburg for supposedly having a cracked windshield. And this man, who's about 53, I've seen contradictory press reports. Some say he's 53, others say he's 63, but in any case, he's what would be considered middle-aged. He does have a record of either consuming or trafficking methamphetamine. I think it's methamphetamine possession. I don't think that it was possession with intent to distribute. But that was several years ago. He's been clean ever since. But he was stopped last September a couple of blocks shy of his house and then given a warning for having a cracked windshield. And then as he turned to go, the officer who stopped him pulled the famous Detective Columbo routine. Oh, sir, just one more question. And he started to interrogate Eckert as to whether he was in possession of drugs. And Eckert said, "You've told me I'm free to go. I don't want to talk to you anymore, and I don't have any reason to." And the deputy sheriff who stopped him said, "Well, that's very rude, and I now have reasonable suspicion to search you and your car." So he called in a...
Oh, wait a minute. Now suspicion is not a legal reason to search a car. You have to have
probable cause. You have to have probable cause.
Exactly.
But they eluded that distinction. You have to have probable cause to conduct a search. You can have reasonable suspicion to conduct an investigative detention, supposedly. And this all, of course, is positivist. I don't subscribe to any of it in terms of the morality of it, but that's what the so-called law, what we're required to call the law, says. But he called in this detective, not a detective, he's actually a sheriff's deputy in Lordsburg, called in a number of other officers, including a canine officer, and they searched Mr. Eckert. This is just a couple of blocks shy of his house, remember. And they searched his car. Actually, they impounded his car and took it away and searched it very thoroughly. They found no evidence that he was in possession of narcotics or that he had cashed them in his automobile. This is last September. But I think his attitude had been noticed because he had asserted his rights not to have any further contact with the police once the purpose of this investigative stop was concluded. And so I believe, on the basis of the fact that you had at least two police officers involved in this traffic stop and only one would have been sufficient, and the one who actually witnessed the purported infraction didn't conduct the stop, I think they were lying in wait for him. Because after they stopped him for supposedly going through a stop sign, they pulled exactly the same routine that had happened in September, the "excuse me, sir, one more question" routine. And this time they brought in about a dozen officers, including two who were involved in a border narcotics task force operated by the Department of Homeland Security. And they brought in a drug sniffing dog who is not certified in the state of New Mexico, hasn't been for several years. They call him Leo, L-E-O, that stands for law enforcement officer. And they once again searched him and they searched his car. But one of the deputies who showed up said, apropos of nothing in particular, that Eckert supposedly had a reputation in Hidalgo County for smuggling narcotics in his rectum. Now, that's either a rumor, in which case, of course, it's not evidence, or that's something that was simply invented on the spot. And one thing that we do know on the basis
smuggling them where? To Walmart? It's not like
exactly. Why would he? Yeah, why would he be smuggling drugs to Walmart or smuggling drugs from Walmart, et cetera, et cetera? And so on the basis of this lie or rumor, they detained him and told him he wasn't under arrest. He was handcuffed. He wasn't free to go. That means he was under arrest. But when he requested a phone call to contact an attorney, he said, no, you don't get one because you're not under arrest. They contacted a judge, a very compliant judge. Actually, they didn't. They contacted the assistant district attorney, a man by the name of Daugherty, and said that they wanted permission to conduct a search of his person and his vehicle, including his body cavities. And so the assistant DA went to a judge who rubber stamped this. Most of these search warrants are simply ratified sight unseen by judges. And the warrant allowed a physical search of Mr. Eckert's car and his body cavities during the hours of 6 in the morning to 10 o'clock in the evening on January 2nd. And of course, this was something that was supposed to take place within Luna County because this was the area of the supposed infraction. They took this hapless man, this abductee. This is not somebody who was under arrest. This is a straight up abduction. They took him to an emergency medical facility there in Deming. That's a town of about 14,000 people. And they requested that the attending physician conduct a hands-on inspection of his body cavities. And Dr. Ash, that's how he's identified in the lawsuit, to his considerable credit, said that's unethical. It's against my Hippocratic responsibilities. It's illegal. I won't be party to this. And so the officers who had abducted Mr. Eckert simply shrugged and said, well, let's go doctor shopping. They contacted Daugherty. Daugherty said, send them over to this facility in Gila, which is in a separate county, where apparently they have a longstanding arrangement with at least a few of the people who are on staff to do this sort of thing. So they took him out of the jurisdiction, thereby violating the terms of the search warrant. The original physical search took place at about 9:45 in the evening, and it consisted of an X-ray, an abdominal X-ray that showed that he had neither been carrying anything in his rectum, nor had he secreted something in his descending colon. And if the search had been valid, that would have satisfied it. But it wasn't valid because, once again, it was taking place in a different jurisdiction. But after this happened, they subjected him to several hands-on invasive searches of his rectum and his descending colon. Jeez. They forced him to undergo, I believe it was 3 enemas, and then a full-on colonoscopy. And a colonoscopy, of course, is an invasive surgical procedure for which he has been billed $6,000 by the emergency clinic there in Gila. And of course, they didn't find anything, but as Fletch put it in the movie, it was not for a lack of looking. But if they had found something, it probably would have been inadmissible because they had violated the terms of the search warrant. And there's a pretty substantial body of judicial rulings that suggest that unless you have clear-cut, hard, probable cause, you can't do any of these things. And what they had basically was either rumor or something that was simply exaggerated by a professional liar, which is a pretty good synonym for police officer.
This is all against his will as well. I mean, he did not adhere.
That's the most important consideration here. When you forcibly penetrate the intimate anatomy of another person who is an unwilling participant, that's object rape. Under any state statute that deals with sexual assault, that qualifies as object rape. It doesn't matter what costumes you wear, what title you claim. Doesn't matter what piece of paper you're waving somebody's face, if you are penetrating somebody's bodily orifices and that person is an unwilling participant, you've committed object rape. And as you pointed out, Ryan, this is not a unique case. You mentioned that there is a second case.
Yeah, Timothy Young in the same area. Timothy,
in the same city with many of the same officers and in the same clinic. He was taken out of the jurisdiction once again. And then there's a third case that has been reported, an anonymous woman who underwent a forcible invasive search of her private anatomy in New Mexico. So I like to say once may be an anomaly, twice a coincidence, but 3 or more instances, you've got a pattern. And it's not limited to New Mexico by any means. I've written about a very similar procedure that is apparently fairly commonplace in the state of Utah involving forced catheterization in order to obtain blood alcohol content levels or to search for evidence of consumption of some other state prescribed substances. There are at least 2 or 3, I believe 2 for sure, and perhaps a 3rd case of that sort that's taken place in the state of Utah. That's object rape as well.
I know these crimes are less severe than the anal rape and vaginal rape, but they also charged to impound the car, and they charged for
yes.
the forced procedure that the person objected to. And the way exactly. our healthcare system is, that can drive you into debt.
Oh, yeah, that can drive into bankruptcy or to suicide. You can lose everything. Medical debt's very tenacious, very difficult to get rid of. And as you point out, because of the artificially inflated prices that come with the veterinary ethic and our corporatist healthcare system, these things are all prohibitively expensive. And you've got a really perverse situation here where the victim of officially sanctioned rape is being given the bill for the procedure that degraded and traumatized him. And in the cases of the people in Utah, of course, you've got a very similar state of affairs. And we've also seen, and this is something you probably talked about with your listeners, several examples of roadside body cavity searches in states like Texas. And also in Milwaukee, there is a so-called rogue street crimes unit that was conducting public roadside body cavity searches. One of them was not so much a search. And these, of course, are all pretextual. These are not searches. They're simply rituals of humiliation and degradation for people who have crossed the police or made them look bad, or just a way that some psychopathic, sadistic characters can receive some kind of prurient satisfaction of their prurient impulses. In one of the instances in Milwaukee, you had a man who was so physically mutilated by this that he had to undergo surgery. There was a task force in Atlanta called Red Dog, and that's an acronym that stood for Run Every Drug Dealer Out of Georgia, as if such a thing could happen, that conducted body cavity searches, strip searches and body cavity searches in broad daylight in Atlanta.
It would be more accurate to say run every rival drug dealer out of it.
Yes, exactly. You run every non-state sanctioned drug dealer out of Georgia, run every non-CIA allied drug dealer out of Georgia. Because you're talking here about a cartel in the classic sense, something that is facilitated by government and has an artificial monopoly because of government intervention. But the point is that this is something which is geographically diversified, and it's something that has been institutionalized. And so this is not by any means, once again, anomalous. This is simply a particularly gruesome example of what happens when government denies at the most rudimentary level, the concept of self-ownership. If they're going to claim jurisdiction over our bloodstreams and over the content of what we consume and process in the bodies that we were given by nature, if you will, if they're going to make that type of a claim of collective ownership, then it shouldn't surprise us that at any given opportunity they will treat us this way, because as far as they're concerned, our bodies are the collective property of this abstraction called the state, and they can be used as those who act in the name of the state see fit.
Well, this rape and theft is actually minor to some of the things they do. They've also openly, I hear every other day about the police just killing people. They'll kill innocent people while
sure.
they're sleeping in their bed and get put on paid leave. Nothing happens to them.
Yeah, there's this.
Lita Jones in Detroit, I mean, a 7-year-old girl shot in the neck after they broke into the wrong house because they were showboating for one of those stupid cop TV shows.
Yeah.
Went in the wrong house, assaulted the grandmother, and killed a little kid who was asleep. And got put on paid leave.
Yeah, Joseph Weekly is still free and apparently has not been convicted. There was a hung jury earlier this year in the criminal homicide trial of Joseph Weekly. And his story was that his gun just went off. And it's interesting. These are people who supposedly have the unique skill set and the unique set of competencies that would permit them to own and use fully automatic weapons or semi-automatic weapons, depending upon the team and the circumstances. And yet he said that he went into he was one of the first into this abode. They were after a murder suspect who could have been arrested very simply if they had staked out the place and then moved in on him when he came out of the home. And he didn't live in the same living space. It was a duplex where he had two separate dwellings, and the murder suspect, the homicide suspect, was in the dwelling at the top of this two-story house. And so some quite unspectacular, conventional police work would have resulted in an arrest that would have endangered nobody. But as you pointed out, Ryan, this is an example of what I call Showtime Syndrome, where you had cameras with a film crew from, I believe, an A&E program called SWAT. It was SWAT Detroit, this specific brand of that so-called reality show franchise was called SWAT Detroit, and they had a cast list that included Joseph Weekly, and he was listed as a cast member. And this is the sort of thing where some of the degenerate fantasies of Hollywood intersect with the degenerate policies of the government that claims to rule us, where you have sort of RoboCop meets real life. You know, in the RoboCop world, as projected by Verhoeven back in 1987 in that bitingly acerbic satire, you had reality television as an adjunct to law enforcement run by the corporate government of Detroit. And it's very much the same kind of thing that resulted in the murder of Ianna Stanley. Stanley Jones, I guess, is the proper pronunciation of the name. I think she had a hyphenated last name. She was, I think, 7-year-old. She was sleeping peacefully in the living room of her own house right next to her grandmother. And somebody threw in a flashbang grenade and set her on fire. And within a few seconds later, she was dead. And the first impulse, of course, was to blame the family. It's to blame the people on the receiving end of these consecrated rounds being fired by members of the putative priesthood. But that's a really good example of the fact that there is this assumption here that the police are entitled not only to commit aggressive violence, but they're entitled to special consideration before the law because of this utterly reprobate doctrine called qualified immunity. Mm. Now, under qualified immunity, you have to go through multiple redundant layers institutionally before you can demonstrate that a police officer is acting in a way that is known to be illegal and unconstitutional, and that is not what a reasonable officer in the same circumstances would do. And all the presumptions benefit the aggressor in these episodes.
Well,
it's
one set of laws for the men in costumes and another set of laws for all of us plebs, the hoi polloi. I do want to point out that there are so many examples, unfortunately. We're not cherry picking one particular bad incident in Detroit. Cops kill people all the time, innocent people, and get away with it all the time. It's impossible to go over all the cases, but that was just one that I happened to use as an example for the 7-year-old girl. But we're not cherry-picking these incidences. This happens all the time. People get tased, pepper sprayed to death, beaten to death over nothing. And the cops are exonerated. And sometimes it doesn't even reach the point of qualified immunity. Investigate themselves. Of course, they're not going to investigate themselves. Make excuses and nothing happens.
One of the things that will always happen when there's a lethal use of force or a conspicuous use of force that looks really bad, and this is one of the reasons why, in spite of the fact that police are people who do not have any reasonable expectation of privacy when they're carrying out their public duties, they always treat cameras as a weapon when they're in the hands of the citizenry. They want our dealings to be completely transparent, and they want their actions to be completely opaque. And that's one of the reasons why when you have a camera or a cell phone or an iPad or something else that can record and make an objective record, an objective chronicle of what the police are doing, they really do not like that. And they'll often confiscate cell phones and other cameras when they're in the hands of citizens who are monitoring what police do. And they'll often arrest people and charge them with wiretapping or some other spurious infraction or spurious crime when the citizen is keeping vigil over what the police are doing. But one of the things that you mentioned, Ryan, is that this is the sort of thing that happens every day. And when there are instances of force, often lethal force of this kind, one of the first things that an officer will do is he'll invoke the Garrity rule. And what the Garrity rule says, this is a result of a Supreme Court decision called Garrity, is that during the initial investigation of a use of force or a lethal use of force by a police officer, if he wants to discuss what happened in detail with investigating officers, he can do so, and nothing that he says in the course of an internal affairs investigation can be used for criminal prosecution. And so what will usually happen is that within a very brief period, a day or two, during the original investigation, under the Garrity protection, a police officer will talk with internal affairs, and he'll also talk with a police union attorney, and they will develop a narrative that will be designed to exculpate the police officer There are some jurisdictions where police officers are almost never held accountable in any way for shootings or other fatal uses of force. Las Vegas is probably the most notorious example. They have a so-called use of force review policy that always exonerates the police officer, irrespective of the details of the case. All that the police officer has to do is use some version of the standard catechism of self-exculpation. I feared for my life. He made a sudden movement. He made a furtive gesture. I couldn't see whether he was armed. I was worried for my safety and the safety of my partner and the safety of the public. And so I had to neutralize the threat, some version of that. And
like
so
the kid they shot who went to the store in his dad's truck or something, and he wouldn't turn his engine off, maybe listen to music or whatever, and they just shot him dead. I mean,
yes,
that was last week.
Yeah. And that's a really good example of something that too many people ignore, which is that the worst thing you can do if you're having trouble is to call the police. Unless you want somebody to be killed, don't call the police. Because the one thing that they do exceptionally well is kill innocent people. They're no good at all in most instances when you're talking about protecting somebody from a criminal threat. And they have no enforceable civil or legal responsibility to intervene when somebody is actually being threatened. That's another part of this equation that most people ignore. Supposedly the police exist to protect us, but in any given circumstance where a citizen is being threatened, either in terms of his person or property, is facing in that minute an immediate threat, a police officer does not have to intervene according to the existing standards and precedents.
But that's something there's a lot of people don't know because of the propaganda of all these cop and lawyer shows. And all these cop and lawyer shows show you that they're the good guys and they never rob or harm anybody. Even though reality would say otherwise, you get this CSI and Law and Order and all these shows, and it's indirect, it's subtle propaganda. They're like, look, the police are only out for your best interests, and they never hurt anyone, even though time after time they're the ones caught running the drugs, running prostitution, stealing from people, killing people, raping people. It's just another gang in blue. But
yeah, and
on TV, they're so awesome, and so you have people naively calling the police when they're in trouble, and, of course, it just makes the problem worse.
Yeah.
At best, they show up after the crime has happened and say, oh, what was he wearing or whatever, and they don't actually do anything.
If we're going to have some kind of government security forces of the sort we're describing here, and I think that's a very debatable proposition as to whether they should exist, they should be reactive in that way. They shouldn't be proactive. And, of course, most of what they do is proactive because you could round up to everything. That category of police activity that has nothing to do with protection of person or property, but everything to do with collecting revenue or regimenting the innocuous behavior of people according to a set of legislative enactments that are positivist and that have no connection to the non-aggression principle. I mean, the chief function of police is not protection of person and property. And if we had peace officers who were involved in that role, they'd be like a volunteer fire department. They would respond and they would investigate. And when circumstances were appropriate, they might intervene in the same sense that any citizen can intervene to protect another who's facing the threat of aggression. But they're essentially a state-licensed cadre of revenue collectors and Budinskis who regiment people's behavior. Most of what they do is vice enforcement, enforcing laws against vices as if vices were crimes, and they're not. But that's the character of law enforcement today. And as you point out, Ryan, we're in an environment of immersive propaganda where we're supposed to prostrate ourselves with gratitude because such people exist. And we're constantly told about the supposed merit of the rough men who stand ready to protect us in our beds when we're more likely to come under threat by those rough men while we're in our beds.
In my lifetime, I have been assaulted and harassed by police more than any citizen. I haven't gotten any fights on the street or anything like that, but I have had to put up with police, and I wasn't doing anything wrong other than being a teenager or you know, driving while young or whatever. And I see police beating the hell out of people. Every time I used to live in Virginia and I'd go by the UVA football game or whatever, and they'd be beating the hell out of somebody because they were drunk or whatever, because they can. And, that's where I always see the violence is from the cops. My house has been robbed twice. Police didn't do a damn thing. They had to settle it on their own. They're just useless, in my opinion. I wouldn't even give them the peace officer thing or anything. I think we could handle things better. Because you're authorizing people with this sort of economic structure to go out and bait crime using the pretext of drugs or traffic violations. There's like a million traffic laws. It's easy to get somebody on something if you follow them long enough.
Yeah.
And they do things like working with certain cartels just to pad their numbers or to get certain quotas or whatever, because they have an economic incentive to do so. Whereas if they can't find crime, they'll create it.
Yeah.
And which brings me back to Deming, because I'm just focusing on them because I think we have a chance finally for them to get in trouble, because I certainly hope so. The hospitals are getting there, are in trouble for what they did already. We'll see about the police. But some of these same officers, if I'm correct, were also involved in trafficking drugs or looking the other way as one of their partners in crime were doing it. And then they're kind of arresting the underlings, but allowing the man bringing it in to walk around free.
Yeah, you're talking about the people who were associated with the so-called New Mexico Border Operations High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Task Force.
Are these which the DHS guys as well?
Yeah, this is a multi-jurisdictional task force. This is operated out of the Department of Homeland Security Investigations Office there in Deming. And Deming, once again, is a town of about 14,000 people, is geographically situated to be a very lucrative node in the so-called war on drugs. And so you have this office, which was set up, I believe, in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002. And between 2001 and today, they've been paid tens of millions of dollars in taxpayer funds, and they've collected heavenly knows how much in terms of civil asset forfeiture, which is probably the biggest source of revenue in law enforcement. And civil asset forfeiture means you just grab the cars or the homes or the boats or the money, and you don't charge the owner of these properties with a crime, but you claim that the property itself somehow had a nexus to narcotics offenses. So you put the money on trial and you sue the money. And the burden is on the owner of the property to demonstrate that the money or the other property was not in any way implicated in narcotics. And this is a tremendously lucrative racket, and is a racket. It's something which operates through a principle called equitable sharing, which is a really tidy arrangement in which local police and sheriff's offices will confiscate money and property and then turn it over to federal custody so it's out of the hands of the local decision makers who might give it back to the victims. Once it's in the hands of the feds, then the local police can say, hey, it's out of our hands. The feds have got it now. The DEA has it, or the Department of Homeland Security, whatever federal agency is involved in it, the FBI, the ATF, they have custody of it now, and so it's out of our hands. It has to go through the courts. And, of course, the way that the court system is set up is that the preponderance of evidence rather than guilty beyond a reasonable doubt is the standard that's used. And it's used against property that's sued in rem. It's sued against the thing. This sort of thing was going on in Deming for the last 10 or 12 years. And about 6 years ago, there was an officer who was an agent who was with this multi-jurisdictional task force. His name is Christopher DeSantis. He worked for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department. He blew the whistle on what was going on. What he said is that among the other activities that this task force was involved in was the protection of a heroin smuggler, a fairly significant heroin smuggler, who was bringing loads across the border out of Mexico and then selling them in New Mexico and to points beyond. And they would work with him and protect him as an informant, and they would conduct these controlled buys. But the thing is, they weren't controlled buys because the drugs were allowed to go and the drug trafficker was allowed to go free, but they would scoop up all the guppies and let the barracuda go. And he said this is very typical. This is the way they were padding their numbers, because the numbers were what were being measured for the purposes of bonuses and career advancement and so forth. And they were bringing in all this money through the federal funds that were coming from Washington and through asset forfeiture. And toward the end of each fiscal year, they ended up with a larger surplus than the year before, but they had to spend it somehow, because if they didn't, they'd have a budget drawdown. They'd have to mark down the budget. It's a familiar thing. Every government agency does this.
Going after the guppies while they work with the barracuda, it's a lot like the war on terrorism.
It's exactly like the war on terrorism. But these agents with the task force there, having all this money that they had to blow, would go out and spend it on high-tech gear that was of no use, or on wonderful office equipment that they didn't need, or vehicles that they really weren't entitled to, or they'd go to training seminars in places like Las Vegas and take this these taxpayer funds and then blow them on donuts and whores that stuff $100 bills into G-strings of strippers and so forth as a way of making sure that their budget wouldn't take a hit. And he blew the whistle, Mr. DeSantis did, in 2007. Of course, he was fired. But the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, did an investigation of this, and they validated all of his findings. They said, yes, there are all kinds of bookkeeping irregularities. There's at least one or two examples where they have been improperly developing informants and then drawing from multiple accounts to pay off these informants. And the reason they did that, of course, was to pad, or rather, forgive me, to disguise the amount of money they were paying out to their protected informants and contacts, who were actually in the business of narcotics trafficking.
They just paid him with multiple accounts. That's kind of lame on their side.
Yeah, that is. I mean, that illustrates the arrogant impunity that these people feel. They know that they're not going to be held accountable. But that's the task force that employs at least two of the deputies who are involved in this rape ring down in Deming, New Mexico. And one of the interesting things that one of the attorneys representing Mr. Eckert said is that there might be sort of an ironic element of racial profiling going on here, because we're talking about New Mexico. We're talking about territory that was historically part of Mexico before it was stolen by the United States. And so it's very heavily Latino. And Shannon Kennedy, who's representing Mr. Eckert, said there's a possibility that they're going after him because he's a scraggly and somewhat disreputable-looking white guy, and they don't like him on that basis. That's a possibility. I don't know if that's a card they want to play, even if there's circumstantial evidence that that's the case, because certainly it doesn't matter. It's not the color of our skin. It's the fact that we're not wearing the same costumes that these people wear, you know, the same gang colors.
I think that's a distraction issue. I don't know if Mr. Young and the other – and the woman who was violated were also white, but, you know – that I think, there are a I lot of white people was, walking around. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think the young lady, as a matter of fact, was Hispanic. Use the familiar category. I don't really like calling it Hispanic. I think she's Latina. So I think you're right. That's a peripheral issue. But it is interesting that just about every one of the deputies involved in this was Latino. And that sort of inverts the standard narrative that you see in places like Los Angeles and Texas, where you've got Latinos who are being beaten and harassed and abused and profiled. And it's a very common thing to see in elsewhere in the United States. But the people who are in charge of creating the official narratives for the rest of us just would love to turn this into an ethnic conflict. You know, having us look at each other with suspicion on the basis of these artificial categories, rather than understanding that the real conflict is between those who claim a monopoly on force and those who claim some kind of collective ownership of the rest of us, between those people and those of us who want to live lives according to the non-aggression principle and recognize the principle of self-ownership right. And things of that kind.
They usually target the poor more than color.
That's true.
And there tends to be some overlap there, and you can make the correlations if you want to, but they usually target the youth and the poor, or people they think who aren't going to be able to fight them with litigation so much, because that's the only thing they worry about. But if they have got a corrupt judge too, then they pretty much just attack whoever they feel like, based on their own personal prejudices or just mad that day, and the next person that comes out of the parking lot is getting it. You know, they don't pay any consequences for what they do. And it's just a guy in a costume with a shiny pin on his chest, and he thinks he can walk around and shoot people, put his finger up their butt or whatever. This is insane. The cops don't act like this in the rest of the world. We didn't even have a police force until 1829. That's shocking for some people that, no, it wasn't all anarchy, and things didn't all fall apart before the police. But these guys, are they going to get in trouble? Do you know if the case going forward? And I also want to ask you about this qualified immunity, because it was my fault, but I got segued into something else. Is there a way or a preferred way that you'd like to get around this qualified immunity? Like, what ought to happen when the police screw up like that? Because if you assume that hurts the taxpayers too, it's just going to it's not their money that they're losing. It's our own money.
That's so. One of the biggest and most important of the many perverse incentives we're dealing with here, which is that the tax victims in a given jurisdiction are called upon to indemnify the crimes of the law enforcement officers who operate on behalf of the tax consuming class in a given jurisdiction. How many times have we seen or heard of somebody saying to a police officer who's being snotty and abusive, "Why are you treating me this way? You work for me. I pay your salary." That's not true. They don't work for you, and you don't pay your you don't pay their salary. Their salaries are paid by the people who steal your money through taxes. So they're not accountable to you. Police are never accountable to you. Very rarely your sheriff's office is accountable to you anymore as well, because owing to the war on drugs and the other federal subsidies that exist, they actually can fund themselves very well and consider themselves to be in a protected relationship relative to the rest of society because of the professional immunities they enjoy. If you have a sheriff who's thrown out of office for misbehavior, he's going to land on his feet. And very rarely do you find a large enough constituency in a given county to throw out a corrupt sheriff. In some places like Maricopa County, you have a demographic cohort that are going to be wedded to Arpaio, you know, this octogenarian, authoritarian Mussolini of Maricopa County. They're yeah. They're completely signed on with the cult of Joe Arpaio. It doesn't matter that he's cost them between $46 and $63 million
in lawsuits and settlements. This is the guy with the pink uniforms for prisoners.
Yeah,
so I think exactly. The police should wear pink uniforms, and the Park Service, both of them.
Oh, the Park Service is inexcusable. Even more so in many instances than the police.
They ruined my island where I'm from. That's a side issue, but
yeah. Mm. But the thing is, the way that the system is set up, in those rare instances, they're outliers, when there's actually some kind of a civil settlement or a lawsuit, an award and a lawsuit, that is in any way proportionate to the damage done by police to an innocent person, it's the tax victims, I don't like calling them taxpayers, that have to indemnify the expenses. Now, there are two things that would be immensely useful reforms, the first of which would be to establish statutorily and through administrative policy, to establish the principle that when a police officer is found to have committed a grievous civil tort or a criminal violation of civil rights that has to result in some kind of a civil settlement, that the money to pay that settlement is going to be taken out of the pension fund of the department that he works for. That's something that would have a tremendously useful effect, because that would, to use an expression I don't like, put their skin in the game. Right now, they're largely immune, and most police officers, even if they're cashiered for cause, will retain their so-called peace officer certification, become gypsy cops, and find themselves hired someplace else. That happens all the time. But on the subject of qualified immunity, here in the state of Idaho, there is a 37-word provision in the Idaho State Code that dictates that you cannot hold a police officer. I'll find the specific verbiage. No peace officer may be held criminally or civilly liable for actions or omissions in the performance of the duties of his office under this chapter, and the chapter deals with assault and battery, if the peace officer acts in good faith and without malice. That's 18-921 in the Idaho Code. We could simply excise those 37 words from the Idaho State Code, or we just delete those and, as a matter of legislative history, assert the supremacy of the legislature under the 9th and 10th Amendments, saying that this is not going to be reviewable as a federal matter. We're claiming jurisdiction under the state constitution. The Idaho State Constitution, by the way, says that all privileges are revocable. It actually says that in so many words. You could actually invoke the passage from the Idaho State Constitution about the revocability of privileges to justify removing this provision, which articulates the principle of qualified immunity from the state code. And that would mean that if a police officer commits a crime of aggressive violence against another human being, then he will be liable to prosecution under the same laws that apply for any other instance of aggressive violence by any other citizen. And I think that would be a wonderful development. At least I would love to see.
But they have fancy hats.
There's the thing. You know, they have fancy hats and costume jewelry.
They have shiny shoes. They can get away with that. They're not the same.
Yeah. Exactly. It's a question of the accoutrements, I guess. But that's the sort of thing that I think could be done. It would be a very simple thing to do, but it would not be easy to do it because of the iron triangle of entrenched interests here that you find in the state of Idaho, like every other state. I'm talking about
Idaho has Sheriff Renee, don't they? Is that Idaho or Iowa with him?
It's Iowa.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not okay. Idaho.
All right. Yeah. Well, I can talk about him later too. But you were go ahead. What you were saying? I interrupted you.
No, I was saying here in Idaho, like every other state, anytime there's a serious effort to reform, and I hate that word, but I guess it's serviceable for the purposes of this conversation, to reform police practice, what will happen is a community-appropriate reenactment of the drama that unfolded in the Berlin Opera House after the Reichstag fire in 1933, when the German Reichstag had to meet in the Opera House to consider the Enabling Act, which created the legal framework for the National Socialist dictatorship. And many of the members of the Reichstag, a majority as a matter of fact, didn't want to pass this, didn't want to enact this measure, which was unfortunately compatible with the Weimar Constitution that would allow executive rule as a matter of emergency powers. And when they were debating this measure, the aisles in the Opera House were filled with brown shirts who sat there looking daggers at legislators and taking down names. That's the sort of thing that happens, once again, adapted for our circumstances. Every time there's a measure being proposed in the state legislature to reform police practices, to create some kind of civilian review board, and I hate that expression too, because police should be civilians, but they see themselves as military, to review civil asset forfeiture. About 10 years ago in Utah, there was an asset forfeiture reform measure being debated, and the Idaho State Highway Patrol, which appropriately enough wears dark brown uniforms, had most of their officers present in the assembly room there in the state legislature in the Capitol in Salt Lake City, silently intimidating legislators as they were trying to pass a law that would make it a little bit more difficult for the police to steal property in the name of asset forfeiture. We had something similar happen here 13 years ago. Yeah, actually 23 years ago it must have been, in the state of Idaho, when the concealed carry law went into effect. They had most of the members of the Idaho Sheriff's Association haunting the halls of the legislature in uniform, staring warily at people and taking down names. You know, that's the sort of thing that happens every time you have an attempt to reform through legislation. And as somebody who is aspirationally an anarcho-capitalist, I recognize that legislation's a very dubious proposition unless it's somehow going to have an impact on the political class. But it would be useful to have this argument, have this fight, get these things out in the open.
Well, I hear you on that too. I just, yeah, as a pragmatist, I was like, I'll take it as a win if we could get it that
sure
way.
Or just to have the fight on the issue and make these things visible, because that will change how people perceive the police. And it's the change of perception, I think, that we need most desperately.
I think that's happening though because of blogs and like yours and radio shows and so on. People are starting to see what the police do, because it's usually no more than a local story and just a blip, but now with social networking and so on, everyone can hear at least a portion of the stories, whereas if you just relied on the Hollywood version, and cops are always a good guy, and there probably are some good cops somewhere. I've never met one. I mean, I assume just from probability that there are some, but institutionally, mm-hmm, you've set up an institution that is going to be corrupt because you've given them so much power and incentive and ability to lie and steal and even murder. But they don't act that way in every country. So it's unique to the legal system in the U.S.
That is an interesting thing. You mentioned that you live in Japan. And I know from many conversations with many American expats who live in Japan that the police behave much differently in that country than they do here in the United States. And I know that you can go south of the United States, you can find ample corruption in Mexico and Guatemala and other countries. But you're a lot less likely, as a common citizen defending yourself, to find yourself in the kind of trouble in those countries that you will find yourself in immediately here in the United States, where any gesture of uncooperation or resistance is considered a crime. If you so much as assume what's called a fighting stance, which consists of putting one foot in front of the other or blading your body or tightening yourself so as to be uncooperative, they call this resisting arrest, and sufficiently inventive cop. We'll call it a form of aggravated assault.
Cops have arrested people for resisting arrest. That's how ridiculous it is. Like, what was the initial? Why were you arresting them in the first place for them to resist that arrest for you to arrest them for resisting arrest?
Yeah,
blah, blah, blah. you know what I mean. But like, it's ridiculous. But
it's a bootstrap paradox.
Policemen in the United States, if they're in uniform, even and outside and just. I'd feel so uncomfortable, I'd just turn around. I'm like, they're just going to do something to me for no reason. I'm American Indian. I look Arab sometimes, so they're just going after me. And it's just it's horrible. But I see a policeman in Japan, and it's great. It's like, you know, I can ask him directions, whatever. They're actually helpful. It's strange. It's really bizarre. But the laws here are very different, too. You can openly buy alcohol from vending machines and drink in the middle of the day with an open container as long as you're an adult. And this is not illegal. Like a lot of things, there's so many laws in the United States, and 2/3 of all the lawyers are also from the United States. And so, like, just about everything is illegal. It's hard enough just to open a business legally, but you can't even travel somewhere without the paranoia of the police finding some minor infraction to come harass you with.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the preponderance of lawyers here in the United States. That's something that's sort of baked into the cake of our culture and our custom. Something Tocqueville noticed way back in the early 19th century is that Americans were very litigious by nature. So that's one of the things to which, unfortunately, we're prone. Another is this really strange enthusiasm, and it tends to be generational in nature. This really strange enthusiasm for regimenting discretionary behavior that would be called vice. Because obviously, from the time that we were a sort of anfractuous collection of colonies and then republics just before and after the War for Independence. I mean, there were plenty of people who find themselves engaged in activity now that would consider to be somewhat disreputable, the sort of thing that you would go to Las Vegas to indulge in. But we have that aspect of our corporate personality as a country. And on the other hand, we have this odd puritanism that erupts in these frenzies of prohibition of alcohol or marijuana, or narcotics, or from time to time, various things that look and like narcotics.
Being scared to death someone else is having fun.
Exactly. That's the Mencken principle that, you know, that Puritanism is the haunting fear that somewhere somebody is enjoying himself.
But it's kind of that type goes hand in hand, because you have like preachers who are making millions of dollars, like Ted Haggard, who are on the side seeing a male prostitute and doing crystal meth.
And doing meth,
Or what's his name, Rush? I don't even remember his last name. Rush something. He's an idiot, but he going to the Caribbean. I know his name, but going to the Caribbean and coming back with all these, you know, like suitcases of Viagra and this and that. Like, gee, what was he doing down there? You know, but the ones preaching against it the most who are doing it.
Yeah, going to the Dominican Republic, which is the chief sex tourism destination in the Western Hemisphere, particularly for underage sex. And he's making a side trip to the Dominican Republic, which is not otherwise the sort of place you'd go. I mean, you know, Hispaniola, that island is not a particularly inviting place. You got
but
the Dominican
Republic. But it's a bastion for Haiti. Ultra-right-wing conservative. Oh, wait. No, it isn't. Perfect place you'd want to go, right? You know,
sure.
Yeah, Bush's brothers seeing hookers in Thailand and so on, and then the Jeff Gannon in the White House with Karl Rove. Mm-hmm. And so it's the puritanical, or usually they just, I don't know, it's a weird thing. Like people, it's kind of like someone for out of the blue coming up and talking about how they're not racist, and that you're like, well, I think you are. You know, who does that? You know. So the people who are hypersensitive to a certain thing or project that, it's kind of like, you know, accusing people of being witches or whatever, they're usually guilty of what they're preaching about.
Well, people who are inclined to audit the shortcomings of others, I think, meet the description that you're offering here. That people who are well settled in their personal ethics and morality realize that they've got plenty on their plate in terms of managing their own lives without assuming to micromanage the decisions of others. And that falls under the New Testament heading of, you know, tending to the beam in your own eye rather than trying to extract the mote from the eye of your brother. It's really interesting. We're a country which is, of course, saturated with a certain type of a populist Christianity, and we don't pay attention to some of the really clear teachings here that fall under the heading of mind your own damn business. I mean, there's plenty of that stuff in the New Testament. You know, Jesus was not in the business of conducting a routine audit of the imperfections of people who surrounded him, and he got in trouble with religious types because he would actually be seen dining with the sort of people who would probably be taking part in pride marches today. Oh, look, he's dining with these people. Does he not know what kind of people these are? How does he call himself a prophet? And he's spending time with people like that. And he said, I know who these people are. I know exactly who they are. You're missing the point. And of course, we're wonderful at missing the point. I've written a great deal about what I call the prohibitionist Pharisees, you know, the sort of people who believe that we can, through the exercise of state-sanctioned coercion, make this a perfect world. And that's the perennial temptation that you find in every variant of totalitarianism. And that's, I think, the temptation to which America, for whatever reason, tends to be uniquely susceptible, is the idea that we can build a better world by forcing people to be superficially righteous. And that's
kind
how
of
we end up.
Paternalism has also justified a lot of neocolonialism. I feel like some of the the liberal racists, where they go in as a, oh, I'm just going to help you, and
yes,
pretext, oh, I'm going to steal all your stuff.
Yeah. What's really interesting is that if you take a look at the roots of prohibition 100 years ago, you had the social gospel sort of modernistic element of Protestant Christianity that gave us the utterly unspeakable Woodrow Wilson, but also gave us, of course, the type of people who are the distant ancestors of the contemporary American Christian right. You know, the people who believe that our duty is to plant the flag and the cross will follow the flag, and that if we smite the dusky heathen in a political sense, then we can at the same time lead them out of the bloodbath into the baptismal font. And it's interesting how often there are these points of correlation between the contemporary sort of Fox News type pseudo-Christianity. I call them the megachurch madrasas, you know, the people who are sort of like the Ted Haggards of the world.
Well, I'll tell you this, because my opinion changed on this when I was young, but what I think now is that the authoritarianism predicates the religion. It's not that the religion makes them so puritanical. It's that they're already authoritarian, and so they're going to make their religion like that, because that's how they already are. And so they're going to use... It could be a different religion if they live in a different part of the world, but they're going to use that as a vehicle to kind of propagate their own ideology of authoritarianism. Because you also have people of the same faith who are not authoritarian, the Ron Paul types or whatever, and who are completely opposite. So I don't think it's a product of the religion per se, but what religion does is exacerbate all of it. Whether it's good or bad, it's going to make it – it's like an amplifier.
Yeah. It's like a lens that focuses the worst impulses here when you're talking about – using this as a justification to impose your will upon other people.
Well, you can't get a higher authority than
exactly
than a god.
Exactly, so, you know, like, as you're a seer, and because you're a seer, your authority is incontestable. Supposedly, on the subject of non-authoritarian strains of what many Americans would consider unlikely religious backgrounds. Have you read Mustafa Akyol's work on libertarian Islam? Because he's somebody, a youngish man, he's in his late 30s, early 40s, I think, he's in Turkey, and he's trying to rehabilitate a 19th century strain of non-authoritarian Islam that's very market-friendly, in many ways much more market-friendly than the monarchical mercantilists of the same era. And I've had so many conversations with people who consider themselves educated because they listen to talk radio and watch Fox News. And I've said, would you please read this
man? That's so funny. Sorry, go ahead.
please read this young man's writing, or please watch this video where he explains the fact that, no, what you call Sharia law does not involve female genital mutilation. That's a custom that had to do with the societies in which Islam has been preached, and it's something that works syncretistically with with certain strains of the religion, but this is not something that was ever dictated by Muhammad. It's not in the Quran. It's not in the Hadith. It's not in any of the teachings. This is something you can find among non-Muslims that live in certain parts of the world, and it just happened to blend with a certain strain of Islam that became blended once again with 19th century nationalism, which, of course, is a wonderful gift to humanity. What a wonderful thing 19th century nationalism proved to be, and 20th century nationalism. But they won't listen to me because they say, oh, he's engaging in taqiyya. Don't you know that these people are taught to lie? Don't you know that they have a religious mandate to lie? Well, they uniquely? That these people and only these people? That sounds to me like a fairly consistent human trait. You know. And the other thing that I've been reading lately is a study of Francis Walsingham,
cops
who's
are
the
coached on how to lie.
Exactly. That's a perfect example I'm talking about here. You can read Norm Stamper's work where he says, look, cops lie. He actually starts a chapter of his book. I think it's called Cops Lie. He said, cops lie. Most of them lie a couple of times a shift at least. And you can see, and I've reported on this, and I've pointed people to the sources where they are actually taught. They're taught how to lie and the ways that they can use lies in order to manipulate people into offering self-incriminating statements that may or may not actually constitute evidence. But one of the things I constantly say in my writings is he's a police officer, which means that he is trained to lie. He's given social permission to lie. So don't talk to him and don't believe anything he tells you, because you're in an irreducibly adversarial relationship with him. So yeah, cops practice what the neocons call taqiyya, I guess, when they're discussing Muslims whose religion they know nothing about and whose backgrounds they know even less about.
Sure. Well, there's a great talk. I'll think of the gentleman's name afterward, or I'll link to it under.
Oh, sure.
It's called Don't Talk to Cops.
Yes.
Or Don't Talk to Police, yes. Perhaps. Pigs,
yeah,
or something.
Never talk to the police. Yeah. And what's interesting is that he had a retired police officer who was there as, to use the old circuit riding preacher's assignment of responsibilities, the attorney was the preacher and the cop was the exhorter. An exhorter and a circuit riding pair of preachers in that team, that type of a team configuration, an exhorter is somebody comes up after the preacher and confirms the message. Well, that's the way that this retired cop performed in this lecture. Got up and said, yeah, he's exactly right. As a matter of fact, he might be understating the case. And he gave chapter and verse examples from his own career as a police officer where he behaved exactly the way that the constitutional lawyer warned people police will behave.
That's right. Yeah, it was a lawyer that did it, and then an ex-cop afterward. Yeah, it's a good talk, and you shouldn't talk to police unless you have to. And usually you don't have to.
But usually don't have to, yeah.
You see a lot of things where people say, well, just exert your rights, and they pull you over and say this and that. And, yeah, that's all nice on paper, but, I mean, I've had cops pull me over, and I said, no, you may not search my vehicle, and they just do it anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's totally against my rights, and so. And I'm too poor to sue them, and so they just do whatever they want.
They count on that,
I remember
yes.
I was coming home. I was going from North Carolina to Virginia. My parents lived in Virginia, and I had seen my girlfriend in North Carolina. It was my birthday, so I spent my birthday with her. And so real late at night, I was going home. But I was going to make it to Charlottesville around 2 in the morning or something. It would have been like 12, but I got pulled over in Rodanthe by a policeman for no reason. I said, why did you pull me over? He wouldn't give me a reason. Maybe sit in the car forever. And then he came and said I had an attitude because I was saying, why are you pulling me over? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get there. And he wanted to search through my car, and I said no. And I had my birthday presents in the front. What are in those? I don't know. They're birthday presents. But I guarantee you it's not drugs or guns or anything. And he actually went through and he opened up my girlfriend and made me some brownies and stuff. And he rummaged through them, you know, like his fingers and stuff. Jeez. So I couldn't eat them. I was like, anyway, that's just another example, you know. For nothing. And then I sat there for so long, him running everything, trying to find some dirt on me that, I had to stay awake very late to finally get home. I had to pull over between Richmond and Charlottesville and sleep because I didn't want to drive while I was too groggy. But I would have made it home had I not been harassed by the police for nothing before the Bonner Bridge.
Wow.
Just a jerk. Here I am searching it. And I'm like, I could hit him or something. He was just a fat, out of shape guy. It would have been easy for me to take him out. But if I did that, I'd be in more trouble. So I have to just let them search my car and waste my time, you know.
Well, that what you just said there reminds me of what Edmund Burke wrote in my favorite essay of his, which he wrote in his, I guess you'd call it sort of proto-anarchist young adulthood, which was about the difference between natural society and political society. It was a vindication of natural society. And he talks about the fact that in what he called policed societies, you have this artificial grant of privilege to certain people
who have
in
a
such
chip
a way
on their
that,
shoulder.
Yes.
Yeah.
You said in natural society, if I'm the victim of violence or fraud, then I am entitled to do anything I can using my own native allotment of intelligence and physical skill in order to obtain justice for myself. But in a police society, if I'm victimized by somebody who's part of this exalted caste, then if I pursue a vindication of my own rights, then the entire cohort of people who are attached to this enforcer will dedicate themselves to my ruin, to completing my ruin. In other words, we're far better off dealing with crooks than we are with cops, you know, on a one-on-one basis. People always say, well, you can't take the law into your own hands. Well, that, quite frankly, is the only way that things will ultimately work, because they're not interested. The third party calling themselves law enforcement are not interested in vindicating your rights. They're the enforcement arm of the political class. That's why they have no enforceable legal responsibility to protect your rights, but they will lose their jobs right away if they do not produce enough revenue for the political class.
And the political class is the enforcement arm of the corporate class.
That's exactly right. It's difficult to tell, you know, which is the head and which is the tail of that beast.
Right.
But,
well, we talk about that a lot.
Sure.
But we just crossed the hour mark, but I'd like to have you back on to discuss some other things that I've been reading in your blog. But it's always fun to bust up on the government enforcement thugs in
sure.
their costumes. So anytime, I'll have you back.
Yeah.
Appreciate
that's
your
time. A very worthwhile conversation. Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, enjoy the
you
conversation.
Take care.
We'll have you back on soon.
Look forward to it. Take care, Ryan.
Take care.